So we should begin, correct, okay. Rabbi Kelman?
Of course, yes.
Okay.
Yes,
sure.
Everybody should be well. That's the most important thing. We should all be healthy and well.
This is class number 39. I've been with you people for a long time. You probably know all my mannerisms and my expressions. It's amazing when you begin to listen to people, you get that sense. Someone emailed me, thinks that we should take the first 15 minutes and combine them and make special shows just for that. I don't know if that means he only listens to the first 15 minutes, but apparently. But really, the truth is that every time you listen to a show, you have to listen to the next week because, as you guys know already, probably 7/8 of what I say, or 90%, is just off the top of my head. I'm not reading anything. And afterwards, I start wondering, was I exact? Like, I'll make a correction. I said something which was sort of correct, but I'm really a duck ache, so I have to make it 100%. But everything follows. Following up that 15 minutes that he liked so much, Ruvain from Paris. Some of you were very interested in the whole, be Michal Shabbos for psychiatric reasons. He calls my attention. I read this, but I forgot about it. The Masoras Moshe of Moshe Feinstein. Incidentally, volume 4 just came out. Volume 1 is the best volume because there's no censorship of it. If you see the other volumes. But on page 93, he has that very question about going to a psychiatrist on Shabbos and how Rav Moshe was mater if the psychiatrist thought that it was pikuach nefesh, but not as a general rule. So you can check that out. He also called, last week we spoke about how the Ashkenazim, they were so opposed to Haskalah that then all of a sudden you couldn't do Diktuk, you couldn't do Tanakh. He called my attention to another thing, which I knew, but he reminds me of it. In Chakira 13, there's an article by Rabbi Muskin, which includes a letter from Rabbi Bloch of Telz, who attended the Yom HaTzmaut celebration, the whole thing. But in there, he speaks about the mistakes we've made, that the Agudists, the yeshiva world, was not able to find support among the people. He says, not because of our stance against their incorrect views. It's not that they opposed us because we opposed their wrong views. No, listen to this. It's because of our negative position against the correct views, such as learning Bible, speaking Hebrew, and Eretz Yisrael. The populace cannot understand our concerns. Rabbi Bloch says the reason we have no influence is because we were in opposition to things that we were wrong to be in opposition to, namely Tanakh, speaking Hebrew, and Eretz Yisrael. And he explains how the attitude was, if the irreligious are doing it, if the Mizrahi are doing it, then Dafka, we have to be opposed to it, which makes no sense, as he points out. So thank you for that, Ruvain. We're going to be devoting today, I'm going to, in a minute, I have to return to this issue of the lice eggs, because I got 5 emails about this. And I began to respond very strongly, defending my position. By the time I got to the 5th email, we have Benny, we have Rabbi Mordechai, we have Avi, we have Ruvain from Paris, and one more. I'm not so sure. So we're going to go through the sugya, and I'll explain to you why it's problematic. But before we go to that, and that's going to be the last thing we do, in introduction, we're going to be spending today's class in the very long letter of Rabbi Mazuz. And believe me, I'm going to take you from 19th century Lithuania. Well, wait till you see everything we cover. Since we are going to focus on him, we spoke last class about all the people attacking him. And look, there's lots of attacks. And it's funny, the attacks, they call him a maskil and everything. All these attacks, incidentally, they're not really about the issues. The attacks are about who's going to lead the Sephardic world. So for instance, let me pull up my screen here. Is the Sephard, and so therefore, if you can delegitimize someone for their views, that's the best way to do it. Now, I want to pull up something on the screen here. Where is it? I'm looking on my, here. Hold on a second. Now let me get the screen here for you. Where is it? Okay, so is the Sephardic world going to be led by these two, Rabbi Mazuz and Rabbi Amar, or is it going to be led by the other people? And if you attack Rabbi Mazuz as a maskil, the whole thing, it makes no sense. It's all stupid. What are you maskil? I'll show you something in a minute. There was no Haskalah in the Sephardic world. So to say that if you have these, like here, let me show you something. I have a book here. Can you see it? Chazon Yosef, and it says, Haskalah v'hatikduk, Kesher Aduk, and it's an attack against Rabbi Mazuz. What, since when did Sephardim have anything to do with Haskalah? When they study Tanakh, because that's what you're supposed to do and study Hebrew. But these Sephardic rabbis, the extremist Sephardic rabbis who've gone to the Ashkenazic yeshivas, they've bought into this whole thing about Haskalah, which is not part of their culture at all. If anyone's interested in this, I can send you, I have many other pieces, attacks, calling him a maskil and all this, which is completely taking the Ashkenazic opposition from the 19th century and putting it into the Sephardic world. On another matter, in terms of criticism, I played you Rav Yitzhak Yosef's attack last week, and I have a lot of respect for Yitzhak Yosef. I included letters in my book. He's obviously one of the great poskim, but that's what he is. He's a posek. He's not, I don't think it's an insult to say, he's not wide in terms of his range. And I also don't think it's an insult to say that you can't compare him to Rabbi Mazuz. It's just, it's like when the people would attack Rabbi Soloveitchik. We're dealing with different leagues, if I may say so myself. I don't think, and fundamentally, the question I think is, in the Sephardic world, is it going to be a Haredi Sephardic society? Or is it going to be a Sephardic society that, for instance, can play the following? Let me play you, Rabbi Mazuz, something that just play for 30 seconds. Or is it will be a Sephardic where you can have the rabbi say as follows, and pay and listen carefully, those who know Hebrew.
Achenu hayeli Yisrael hanelhamim al mishmar asenu v'arei Elohenu shehakadosh baruch hu yishmor etchem, yishmor setchem, uvoachem, shalom.
In other words, are you going to have, this isn't religious Zionism from him, but it's a recognition of the significance of the state, of the importance of the soldiers. And that really is the old Sephardic way. That's the way of Chacham Avad Yosef, the Rav Uziel, etc. Or are you going to go the Ashkenazi Haredi world, which because of its history doesn't want to have any identification whatsoever with the structure of Israeli government, the army, all these sorts of things. In the Sephardic world, saying the prayer for the Chayalim, what's the problem? Of course you say the prayer. So why do I mention all this? Because in this week's weekly shiur, last week, number 249 from Rabbi Mazuz, he says something which they can again use to attack him as being a maskil. So what is it? Okay, he talks about Parsha Zohar. Oh, incidentally, hold on. I'm gonna have to show you my Purim thing in a minute as well. Parsha Zohar. And he points out that none of the Sephardic authorities, in the Sephardic world, women never went, as I mentioned, women never went even in the Ashkenazic world until recently. But he says it's a big machokas. The Sephardic poskim, the Rambam, etc., they all assume that Parsha Zohar is Durabonim. The only people who hold its Daraisa Torah law are the medieval Ashkenazic authorities. And he says as follows, this is in note 14. He says that the Ashkenazic, Chachmei Ashkenaz, because they lived such difficulties under the Gezerot, the Crusades, etc., they were very machmir when it came to Parsha Zohar, and they applied their current enemies, namely the Christians, they put them under the category of Amalek, Ukasher hayu korim Zohar, hayu mechavenim al harashayim ha'elo. So, basically, the Christians that they were living in became a stand-in for Amalek, and because they wanted to stress, because they were having such difficult times, how bad this was, they turned it into a deraisa. And the Sephardim, who are living under a much more tolerant regime, they didn't have that. So basically, this is from the Jacob Katz, Ephraim Orbach, Yaakov Katz, Chaim Soloveitchik playbook, interpreting halacha based upon medieval halacha based upon societal circumstances. He's saying that the Ashkenazim, who stress that Parsha Zohar is Torah law, it's because they were viewing the Christians as a Amalek, and that they were so present in their life that it had to be Doraisa. That's the sort of thing that I can see them saying, there you go again, all that Haskalah. Eli Turkel. Thank you. He called my attention to this. I didn't know about this, that Israel Public Radio 2 years ago played Wagner, and they had to apologize for it. This is on the BBC. You can read it, the whole story here. And at the end, they quote someone, where is it? Who's this Jonathan Livni? He's head of the Israel Wagner Society, which I never could have imagined there's an Israel Wagner Society, but he thinks it's important to listen to Wagner. So thank you, Eli, for that. I forgot I had the things on the floor, so I have two more things. Those who've listened to my, since it's Purim, I'll show you. Those who've listened to me for years know that a couple times I said, I love this Ashkenazic, this Litvish yarmulke they wear, and I don't know where to get it. Well, so I thank, two people sent it to me. One, I forget who, the other, Yecheskel Moskowitz. So here it is, everyone. You can see it here. This is what Rav David Lifshitz wore. This is what Rav Moshe Feinstein wore. But I also, every year for the last few years, this has been my, I hope I can still wear it. This has been my kippah on Purim. That's the extent of my costume. Here you go. Make Shul great again. And I picked this up at the a few years ago at the 6th Street Community Synagogue. So make Shul great again. There you go.
Rabbi Shapiro in Washington, yes. Heights in Breuer's. This is how you go to the Omid, and this is what the caption you're laying in.
Yeah, that's not exactly what I have.
Same one.
Same one. Okay, very nice. I listened to the tape over, and I just want to be clear. If you listen to the end, it was clear. We spoke about the word chutz. I didn't mean to say, as I said, it's not a biblical word. We know it's a biblical word. It's chutz machaneh. Not only, I mean, we see it all the time. In fact, here, one of the famous verses, where is it? In Yirmiyahu, I wrote it down that, yes, in Yirmiyahu, I think I have it here, Yirmiyahu 7. We all know this, right? In, where is it? Pasuk Zion, Yod Zion, Ba'arei Yehuda uvchutzot Yerushalayim. By the way, chutzot there means streets. What I meant is, and I clarified it at the end, is levad. I looked in the concordance. I could not find anywhere where the word levad, meaning chutz, meaning except or apart from, which is what levad means, appears except in that one pasuk that I showed you in Koheles. So, okay, now, and this will take 5 minutes, we'll go an extra 4 minutes, I see. I want to get back to that point because many people email me about, and here I have the Gemara. Let's look at the Gemara quickly. The Gemara, and this is in Shabbos 107b, is discussing, it establishes that unless something reproduces, there's no prohibition to kill the creature. And let me just read you the English, but then I'm going to go back to the Hebrew. And they say that lice doesn't reproduce. So then, here we go. Abaye, you see the marker? Abaye says to Rav Yosef, and lice do not procreate? Didn't the master, Mar? By the way, this is quoted in Avodah Zarah also, and it's, I believe it's Rav who says it. The Holy One, blessed be he, sits and sustains everything from the horns of wild oxen to the eggs of lice. Vizan mikarnei reimim ad beitzei kinim. So, based as it says here, there's lice eggs. God takes care of everything from the wild oxen until the eggs of the lice. That would show you that, how could you say that the lice don't reproduce in a normal way, as opposed to, let's say, from sweat. And what is the answer here? And by incidentally, this is, hold on a second. This was originally, Abaye says, why does he say it? Okay, before, earlier, it's speaking about Rav Yosef. Rabbi Eliezer says, if you kill lice on Shabbos, it's if you kill a camel on Shabbos, and Rav Yosef objects to this. Okay, so then it says, if you look in the Gemara, in English, it says, Rav Yosef answered him, namely Rav Yosef answered Abaye, there is a species of insect that is called lice eggs, but lice themselves do not lay eggs. So what it's saying is that even when it says that God watches over and takes care of the carnei re'emim to beitzei kinim, it doesn't mean lice eggs. It means a species of Kinim that's called Lysex. Strange, yes. Before I go further, though, I have to point out, this is the Koran. Koran says Rav Yosef answered him. The Gemara doesn't say Rav Yosef answered him, and this is going to be important. Abaye says, is that true, that Kinim do not reproduce? Didn't Mar say that God takes care of the ram's horns and the Beitzei Kinim? Then it's, the answer is, Minahu Demikri Beitzei Kinim. It's not Rav Yosef here. It's the Gemara answering it, the Stam, whatever you want to call it. This is going to be important in a minute for the reason I'm going to tell you. Second of all, when the Gemara then, it goes further and it says, Vahatanya, Tipuyun Beitzei Kinim, it says, again, it was asked, wasn't it taught in the Braisa that they're lice eggs? And then it's, he answered him. Again, it's no, this is the Gemara speaking. Now, why is it, okay, and I'll explain to you why that's important in a couple of minutes. But now let me get to the question. So I said, I didn't mention this last week. I didn't get into this idea that lice eggs, the Gemara here doesn't interpret them as being actual eggs. It's a separate species. What I said was that in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, it refers to lice eggs. And Eli again told me that Ravad Yosef's grandson mentions this. Maybe I saw it. He's citing Ravavadia. Maybe I first saw that there. And the Gemara, Pirkei Derezer says that when Avimelech took Sarah, all the Nekevos in his house, all the females became barren until Beitzei Kinim. So my understanding, and Rav Avadi Yosef, or at least as passed on by his grandson, understood this to mean that this is referring to reproduction. What I was asked by those four or five people was why? Why not assume that Pirkei Derezer, even if it says how you call Nekevo Speso Akaros, when it says Afilu Ad Beitzei Kinim, it means the creatures, not the eggs. So at first I defended my reading, and now I'm saying maybe you're right. Maybe Pirkei Derezer needs to be understood the exact same way, in which case take back what I said. The problem is, that what kind of answer is this, that there's a species that's called lice eggs? The Gemara says lice eggs. And this gets us into, in fact, Ruvain from Paris said recommended I look at Slifkin. So I searched, and Slifkin, amazingly, says that this is extremely strange. And he offers a different explanation of the Gemara. So let me explain what's going on here and why what I said before is so important, at least if you're an academic type, that it's not, it's the later Gemara. Let's say we had this Gemara also in the Yerushalmi. And Abaye cited a source and said that, well, what about the fact that we have this saying from the Mar that God takes care even of the lice eggs? Let's say the Yerushalmi then made it a machokas. Okay, so it's machokas. One holds that there are lice eggs. The other holds it's a species. We wouldn't think anything of it. But all we have is the Bavli. What Slifkin is doing is basically, he's doing what some academic scholars are saying. What he's doing is he's giving a different explanation. He's saying, yes, the Gemara says there's a species of insects that's called lice eggs, but that doesn't make sense. And he's giving another explanation. This is the way academics scholars often, not just academic scholars, if you look at the Tosfos Yom Tov in Nazir, Perikei, Mishnah, the Rambam does it, Reuven of Weinberg does it, Vilna Gaon does it. There's this whole approach that you can give an explanation of the Gemara different than what the Gemara does. In other words, if you read the Gemara the way I said you should, Abaye asked this question, and then the editor explains, no, it's not really a stira, because when Mar says eggs of lice, it doesn't mean eggs of lice. It means a species, a separate species of insect. But who says that that's the absolute answer? This could be even a Savarak answer. And we have examples where Rishonim, I know today if you do this, I'll throw you the base medrash, but we have examples of the Rambam. We have examples of other Rishonim where sometimes they don't feel bound by the later explanations like this. And that's why Slifkin says he offers a different explanation. After saying it's strange, he says that he says it doesn't mean that there is a species of insect called the eggs of lice. Rather, it's referring to nits, actual lice eggs, but not from which lice hatch. So the point is that I really don't know what to make of this the pshat in the Gemara is obviously Beit Zei Akinim refer to a separate species. And that's, you could read, contrary to what I said last week, you could read Pirkei Rabbi Elazar that way, despite what Ravad Yosef's grandson says. But if you want to be a little academic, you can ask yourself, is the Gemara, is that really what it's saying? Or is that they have a tradition that you can kill it, and now you have a stira? The Netziv says that sometimes the Gemara would contort, he uses that word, lakem, explanations in order to bring it in line with the halakha. Is this an example where they're offering an explanation, sort of a dochach explanation, just to bring it into line with the halakha? There's a halakha. We have a tradition that for whatever reason, lice, you can kill on Shabbos. And then you have they give a stira because they say there's lice eggs. And you come up with it. He comes up with an explanation in the Gemara, but this is just trying to offer an explanation. Last week I gave a different explanation that all this happens in a microscopic way. Slifkin doesn't like that. Slifkin says that there are no Rishonim or early Achronim who come up with this idea. So I don't know, but I thank you for everyone who wrote. And it could be that the Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar should be understood the same exact way as everyone, as the Gemara and Shabbos. Okay, let us pick up. If you recall, we were speaking about Rabbi Moshe Kunitz. I mentioned Rabbi Moshe Kunitz. So if you recall, I told you that he wrote, this appears in all the Mishnayos, so they censored it. Todos Rabbeinu HaKadosh. It's a couple pages. And if you go to the next page, it continues. And then you go to the next page, and right at the bottom of the next page, you get the Mamar al Diktuk Lashon HaMishnah that we spoke about. He mentions the point about Koheles. This passage from Rav Moshe Kunitz, it comes out of a larger work. You can see it on HebrewBooks.org called Maisa Chachamim, which is a play. The biography appears at the beginning. Hold on. You can see it here. The biography is at the beginning. Here, Todos Rabbeinu HaKadosh. But following that, you have a play. And it has all the characters. You have Rebbe and Avigail and Gamliel, et cetera, et cetera. And you have a whole play here. So very interesting. And I mentioned to you, I mentioned to you that he was, he's buried right next to Rav Shimon Oppenheim. Here, let me show you something. I wasn't exactly correct in Rav Shimon Oppenheim, how I described. I have a picture of here. I took pictures. I said that if you go to his grave, it says that he will intercede. It doesn't actually say that. What it says is, it says as follows. Everyone who comes to my grave, you should say Menucha Nachona. Menucha Nachona, our Kel Malei Rachamim is an abridged version of this. This is found in the Sefer Mavar Yabok, which has to do with mourning. He says, everyone should say Menucha Yechona. And he says, Vim Yechas V'Shalom B'Tzara, if you're in difficulty, you should pray on my grave, and you should give something to Tzedakah in behalf of my soul. Uvah HaRachamim Yishma, and Shavasam Amen Kiyur Tzon. And God will hear your prayer. So it's not that I remembered it mistakenly that he would intervene. No, God. So here you have an actual guarantee by the great Rav Shimon Oppenheim, which is just two kvarim away from Moshe Kunitz, where he says, if you pray here and you do this, what I tell you to do, God will hear. Of course, you could say God will hear. It doesn't mean he'll listen, but at least you're guaranteed he'll hear. And because of that, this is then a stop for on all the Kvarim tours, because as far as I know, we have no other kever where you're given a guarantee that if you do this, God will hear it. So what we're going to do now is continue in my letter to Rabbi Mazuz. It's a long letter, and we're going to go back and forth. What I say, what he says. And we're on Siman Kuf Mem Aleph, page 297. And I was just talking about, I don't need to repeat it, about Rav Moshe Kunitz and how he was asked the questions in this book. Let me show you another book. I got this ready. The name of the book is,
where did I put it here? Here it is. The name of the book is, you can see on Google Books. That's where I found it. It's called Nogat Tzedek. The first Nogat Tzedek, the first generation of the reformers, they wanted to get halachic justification for using an organ, changing to a Sephardic pronunciation, various things. And they have Italian rabbis, and then they have Moshe Kunitz. They have Aaron Chorin, who at this time was not regarded as a reformer, just a liberal Orthodox. He then becomes the big reformer. We'll get back to him later today. But I point out that Rav Moshe Kunitz didn't know really what was going on. He was just asked the question, so he answers it. Okay, let's stop here. And I mentioned one thing else, that a few years before that the book Ben Yochai that I showed you, which is Rav Moshe Kunitz's defense against the Zohar, defense of the Zohar against Rav Yaakov Emden's criticisms, was reissued. And you know who reissued it? A Satmar publisher. So even in Satmar, they read Rav Moshe Kunitz. So Rav Mazuz replies to me as follows. He says, this is on page 300. He says, regarding Rav Moshe Kunitz, Maisha Shahaya Kachaya. This is what happened. He goes, until a few years ago, I was a subscriber to Yated Ne'eman. Yated Ne'eman is the Haredi, the Litvish Haredi newspaper in Israel. They also have it in America. And he says, then Agav aside, he says, very interestingly, there was an article there titled Let Us Go Assimilate. And among the things, it quoted from Bialik's work, Ir HaHarega, the city of slaughter. And that had to do with the Kishinev pogroms in 1903. And it says in the Yated article that two lines were removed from that when it was published because the Russian censor, who was an apostate, he refused to allow it to be printed so that he would not lose his share in the world to come. And when Bialik went on Aliyah, he reprinted it. So Rabbi Mazuz says, Manyain, he's a Shirot Ela, which it's interesting to know, which can you imagine? Maybe Rabbi Soloveitcher would say it, but a typical Gadol, Haredi type, not Haredi, Haredi type, saying, I'd like to know what to... things there. Well, I pointed out, in fact, in the first version of my book, I say, I think it's these because I read the poem and it could only be those. But in the reprint, which is now in Israel and in America, where I just corrected typos, but here I actually said, not that it appears to me, it is. And I cited two essays, one memoir, actually, and one essay that speak about this whole incident. Ben-Zion Katz, he was involved in this whole thing. So let me show you what's going on here with Bialik and what he's referring to. Because this is a sefer that's found now in Batei Midrash, I did not want to cite the lines. If the lines are so heretical, I didn't want to cite them. I just said it's the two lines that begin, Silchuli Alivayom. Here they are. Let me read it to you in Hebrew and in English. Silchuli, or Bialik would have pronounced it, Silchuli Alivayom, Elokechem, Ani Kamoschem, Ani Hu Chayechem, V'Kalvachomer B'moschem. We know he pronounced that way because he rhymes often with the Ashkenazic pronunciation. Here is the translation. And he's speaking here to the people who suffered the terrible pogrom. Forgive, ye shamed of the earth. Yours is a pauper lord. Poor was he during your life.
You have to argue with me.
Poor was he during your life, and poorer still of late. So here you're saying about God that God is a pauper, that God is not. I mean, that's a heretical thing, obviously. Although you do have like Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, he would like scream out to God and almost criticize God. But here you have a poem saying that God is so weak, he couldn't protect you. Who is your God? So we understand why that was left out. But then Rabbi Mazuz continues. He says, in this Yated Ne'eman, he says, remember, he says, I used to be a subscriber. He says, the editors attacked this essay, Beit Rabbi of Rav Moshe Kunitz. And one of the things they point out, Rav Moshe Kunitz discusses, it speaks there that Rebbe and Antoninus, there was a tunnel that they would go between, and between Sefer Sipori and Romi. And so Rav Moshe Kunitz says, well, it must be a magic tunnel. And he's not the first one they transfer. I even found online someone says that, who knows, maybe it was a miracle. It shows you he's, even though he's open-minded, he's really living in a pre-modern sensibility. We actually know this Rumi is, it's referring to, there's an Arab village that's to this day called Ruma or something like that. That must be what it's referring to. But what did they say in the Yatei Ne'eman? They said that Ramosha Kunitz, he interpreted it as a magic tunnel, so everyone seeing this would see how idiotic the Gemara is, that they believe that you could have a magic tunnel, and they think that Moshe Kunitz is doing it to make fun of the Talmud. It's completely false. That's not why he's doing it. He's doing it because has a simple view of that obviously there must be a miracle here. And then it says, in Yatei Ne'eman, they also mocked the picture of a certain rabbi who obviously didn't know who he was. Who's the rabbi? Let me show you the rabbi. Sometimes people are just so stupid. They don't know how, you know, it's bad to be, it's one thing to be ignorant or to not know, but it's another thing to not know how much you don't know. We all know you don't know something, that's bad, but to not know that you don't know it, that's even worse. And that we can say about this. The Yatei Ne'eman saw this guy starts writing about this person, David Sinsheim, that he was on the French Sanhedrin. And they mocked him, like, who is this phony rabbi appearing on the Sanhedrin, when, you know, I guess Sanhedrin in quotes, with Napoleon, all that. They didn't realize that this is one of the Gedolei Yisroel of David Sinsheim, that he's the Yad David. Hasam Sofer has a whole eulogy for him. He has like 10 volumes of Yad David and also commentary on Talmud and also Minchas Sani, a Talmudic encyclopedia. My best entry in Minchas Sani is Chatul. He has a whole entry on cats and rabbinic writings, cats and rabbinic writings. So then they were told who it is, and Uvikshus, then they had to apologize. But you see, they're looking to attack people. They don't realize they're attacking one of the Gedolim. He was in a difficult situation because the French Sanhedrin, which had secularists and also Orthodox rabbis, where they were asked all sorts of questions. I think I made a copy of it here. One of the questions they were asked. Oh, yeah. They were asked by Napoleon. This is the question I had to answer. Remember the circumstances. Can a Jewess marry a Christian? Are you can't say that Jews, the question is, are you going to be French people or not? Or are you going to be separate, which means that you have to be in the ghetto? So difficult question. So they sort of hedge it and they say that although religiously it can't be done, it says here, it says, according to the Talmud, you need to have a religious ceremony, Kiddushin. So since Jews and Christians are of different religion, you can't have Kiddushin, so there can't be a religious ceremony. They can only be civilly married. You see what they're trying to do? They're trying to not stress too much that intermarriage is really a terrible thing. They're trying to make it into a technical thing. By the way, Joe Lieberman did the exact same thing. Go back. He'll be on YouTube, I'm sure. Listen to him on Imus when he was asked about intermarriage. And Joe Lieberman punted it. He didn't answer honestly. He said, well, it's a custom of long standing. I mean, he wouldn't acknowledge that it's actually forbidden. And my friend, I remember, said to me, he just should have said it's because after the Holocaust, you know, no one's going to touch you. You can't, or you could, but it's becomes a hard thing in today's day and age. And it was a hard thing 200 years ago. But this is one of Gedolei Yisroel. There were other Gedolei Yisroel who were at the Sanhedrin. This was the leaders of the Jewish community. He was the head of the Sanhedrin of Yosef Sinsheim. So they attack him, they mock him, knowing nothing about him. This reminds me, after my book on Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg came out, someone in the Allgemeiner Journal who knew nothing about Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg wrote an attack on him, like this, treating Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg as if he's some left-wing rabbi and that he knew a little. He wrote some responsa, but really degrading him. And I said to people, this guy doesn't know who Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg is. He doesn't know that he'd be put in cheren by Moshe Sternbach and Rabbi Shiner. He doesn't know that in the yeshiva world, you're supposed to respect Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. He's not the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik. This guy, he doesn't even know that on the contrary, you're supposed to grab Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg and hold on to him and push away people like me. So the same thing with Rabbi Sinsheim. And then Rabbi Mazuz says, and then he says, listen to this. And they continue to attack Rabbi Avad Yosef and Rabbi Bakshi Doron or Adin Steinzos, Uchamuvan, Admor Mi Lubavitch. And of course, I mean, that was their big attack against the Lubavitch Rebbe. And he says concerning these people, the sages say, who is your anger not, your evilness not been upon? And then he says, then I stopped this, this piercing, I guess, this yateid, this bad newspaper. And it is a bad newspaper. The American newspaper is a terrible newspaper either. I remember years ago, they came out with treating Rav Udalia Dov Schwartz like he was some left-wing, open Orthodox rabbi, not one of the great poskim, because he had a different view on conversion. It's par for the course. And then he says, and this is amazing, from the Haskama of Rav Moshe Kunitz in the book Nogat Tzedek, the Haskama, really the letter, he says, I understand why the Haredim Hashkenazim Hayom, why the Ashkenazi Haredim today are not prepared to accept Habitoy Hamitila Ayin V'chet. They're not, you can teach them, but they refuse to pronounce the Ayin and Chet properly. And he says, the Kori Momishim Abateotam Lenachon Apikoris. And they call people who actually will pronounce the Chet and Ayin properly an Apikoris. And then he writes in parentheses, Kasher Katavli. And I dot, dot, dot. What's the dot, dot, dot? In his original letter to me, he cites this person, a well-known Hasidic figure, or semi-well-known Hasidic figure in London, who's also into tiktok. But I thought that maybe he'd get in trouble because he's saying, he's making fun of all the people he lives with, that if you pronounce it properly, they call you an apikoros. So I actually got in touch with him, found his email, and I asked him, I said, Rabbi Mazuz mentions you by name, that you said that any among the Ashkenazi Haredim, if you actually pronounce the letters properly, they call you an apikoros because you're a maskil. Should I mention you? He says, no, don't mention me. Take me out. He said, I have to live with these people. So that explains the three dots there. And he says, but I understand why they don't like Rav Moshe Kunitz, because this is one of the things the reformers wanted to do, and Rav Moshe Kunitz agreed. And if you look, I'll show you right now, what he's referring to is as follows. I think he's the only Gadol who knows Nogat Tzedek. Who reads this stuff anymore? So here's the letter of Moshe Kunitz. And he says... he was one of the questions he was asked was that the new Reform synagogue, they started davening with a Sephardic pronunciation. So he says as follows. First of all, he says that all tefillos go to heaven. Then he says that of the Jews, seven chalakim use the Sephardic pronunciation, and the eighth chalak is the Ashkenazic pronunciation. I don't know where there's something about that in the Ari, but. Certainly it's not numerical. And then he says, there's no doubt of how many there are. The truth is that in the 19th century, there are more Ashkenazic Jews than Sephardic Jews. But whatever, he says, he didn't know that. He says they dwell in Tunis, Tripoli. Anyone know what this word is? Pei Ayin Tet Sadi. It took me a while to figure out what he's talking about. Then he says afterward, Morocco and in all of Africa and Asia. But I'm wondering, what is pets? It's in Africa? What could it be? And then I realize, you know what it is? It's Fez. This is one of Yosef Messas's books, Mayim Chayim. We'll see if anyone got it. I can't see the chat at the moment. Fez. So why does he call it... because he saw it written F-E-Z. And in German, Z is written like Zeit, like Z, like if you want to say, for instance, the newspaper, it's not Zeitung, it's Zeitung. So he's pronouncing F-E-Z as like the Ashkenazic T-Z. And therefore he thinks that Fez, he never saw a book, I guess, with spelled in Hebrew. It's spelled with a Samech. So he says that you can, and then he goes on, he says that the, if you see over here that the great rabbi in Frankfurt, Rav Nussan Adler, he actually prayed with a Sephardic pronunciation. And that's true. Rav Nussan Adler, there was a rabbi Chaim Modai. He wrote a volume of Seros and Chuvos. He was a Meshulach and he lived in Rav Nussan Adler's house. And Rav Nussan Adler learned how to pronounce in the Sephardic way. So Rav Moshe Kunitz says, there's nothing wrong with pronouncing Sephardic. This is the issue that came when the State of Israel, or nearly years before the State of Israel, even Rav Cook dealt with it. All the Rav Cook, all the Ashkenazic rabbis say you can't change it. you have to daven Ashkenazic. And the Sephardic rabbis all say, of course you can, because the Sephardic pronunciation is better. Then we get these day schools. And because of the state of Israel and because of the Hebrew being spoken there, we're all taught as children Sephardic. So our kids grow up speaking mostly Sephardic. We said not completely, mostly Sephardic, not with the pronunciation of Ayin and Chet, but Tuf, Nosuf, things like that. And that's now become pretty standard. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein mentions in one of his essays that when he moved to Israel, he began to daven that way because he figured we're going back to Israel, but he couldn't. Having grown up davening one way, you can't. And if you listen to Ashkenazim, Rashi Yeshiva, when they give a shiur in Hebrew, it's all Ivrit, but then when they start quoting Psukim, then it's all Ashkenazic. So it's a real shotness, a real mixture. So that's the first thing in the letter. Now let's go back in his answer. Now let's go back to my letter, because I continue with my questions. That I'll skip one thing. Let me just say quickly. He mentions in his book, he has a book on Gedolim, and he has a lot on the Gedolim in Tunis and Gerba, and he says he discusses this Rabbi Kalfon Moshe Cohen, which I don't think any of you have heard of him, because if you're an Ashkenazi, I should say, because he's not in our canon, but he was a great, great Torah scholar. And I sent him something that appeared in 1950 in an Israeli Torah journal, Hahed, which mentions things about him, including that he would read Mapu and also Shulman, Kalman Shulman. So I say as follows, in opposition to Mapu, Mapu is considered like the first of these East European Maskilim. So he was public enemy number one in the yeshiva world. He wrote a book called Avos Tzion. And in one of the memoir literature, he tells a story that because there was another book called Avos Tzion, the Notabi Yehuda's son has a book of drushos called Avos Tzion, and the mashkiach, they didn't call him mashkiach in Volozhin, but the guy whose job it was to make sure everyone was on the straight and narrow, he sees the guy learning Avos Tzion, and he thought it was the Mapu's book. He was so ignorant, this guy, he couldn't tell the difference. He took it away and confiscated it. I don't know if he destroyed it, I can't remember, but so Avos Tzion is classic. And when I decided I wanted to read a Haskalah work, I actually got a copy of Mapu. You can still get it in Israel, although this is published, I think, in the 30s. But I say that in opposition to Mapu, Shulman was a Yerei Shamayim and Shomer Torah Mitzvos. So who is Shulman? Kalman Shulman? Here is Kalman Shulman. Let me show you a picture of him. There he is. And you can read all about him on Wikipedia, Hebrew, English. Looks like a Shomer Shabbos. And of course he is, Kalman Shulman. He wrote all sorts of books on Jewish history and other things. Remember, he's Vilna, Lithuanian Maskili. Many of them are what would today, if you look at who used to be, for example, Hadoar crowd, Bernard Revel Graduate School. We're talking Litvisha Maskilim. These are Talmidei Chachamim, but these are modern types. And I say that he lived in Vilna, and it's known that in Vilna there were many Maskilim in quotes, who were Talmidei Chachamim and were close to Gedolei Yisrael. And I don't need to mention in Sarach Omar that they were strict on all matters of halacha. And I said one of these Maskilim was Matisyahu Strashon. Rav Matisyahu Strashon, whose father was the Rashash, and he left all this money. He was wealthy. They built the great library, the Strashon Library. I think I mentioned to you about Dan Rabinowitz's book. Hey, let me pull it up for you here. If anyone wants to see a good book, I recommend on this I showed it to you once. So here, The Lost Library. The Legacy of Vilna Strashon Library in the Aftermath of the Holocaust. A whole book about the Strashon Library. I recommend, he was a great Torah scholar also. His commentary is in the back of the Vilna Shas in Basra. I can't remember where else. And then I say that there's no connection and no similarity between these maskilim, that is the Vilna maskilim, and the other maskilim, let's say Galicia, in Germany. The only similarity is the name maskil, which In Lithuania, all it means is that you knew Diktuk, Parshanut, Shira, Jewish history, just like Gedolei Sfarad, the great Spanish sages in the days of Yehuda Levi and the Rambam. And, regarding Maskilim, again in quotes, like from Matisyahu Strashun and many like him who are not known today, you can say about them, V'hamaskilim yashiru kezoar harakia. This is a pasuk. And this pasuk, Maskilim yashiru kezoar harakia, let me get us again. Here we go. It appears in the book of Daniel, chapter 12, verse 3. There you go. V'hamaskilim yashiru kezoar harakia. And they that are wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. So we see that the word maskilim is used in Tanakh in a positive way. And I say that those maskilim, it's a very positive thing. And then I say, and if these people are maskilim, in quotes, then the Rambam and all the great Torah sages of Spain and Rav Shamshon, thank you, not Rav Shimshon, Rav Shamshon, Raphael Hirsch, and Rav Israel Hildesheimer, and Rav Cook, and Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg, and Rabbi Soloveitchik, and even the Rishash, the father, are also maskilim. And even you, Rabbi Mazuz, you're a maskil, because in addition to your greatness in Shas and Poskim, you're baki, you're knowledgeable in Diktuk, in the songs of Spain, in Piyut, in philosophy, in Parshanot, and they say, therefore, there's no reason to use the term maskil without explaining who it refers to. What type of maskil are we talking about? There are people called Rabbi Soloveitchik a maskil. And then I say, and regarding Bialik, I just want to point out that there were Gedolim who related to him very positively. I already mentioned this. And I say that Bialik was not a Shomer Torah Mitzvos. However, he was what we call a Mechabed Torah. He was a respecter of Torah. When he came to Israel, he became more traditional. He was not like Acharam or Bereshevsky and Chernikovsky. No, and then I point out, as I mentioned already, but I sent to him that Rabbi Chesko Abramsky was a Baki in Bialik's poetry, and it's very different. So that's point four of, actually, it's funny here. It says point three of my letter, but there's no point four is missing. I don't know what happened to that. So let me see, tell you his response to this now. He says, the works of Kalman Shulman, told us Chachmei Yisrael. He wrote a whole thing about Chachmei Yisrael. He says, we had in our home, that is in Tunis, and that's where I learned, you know, the dates of the different rabbis and parshas of Shirei Sfarad. And in one of the early volumes, he says that in his youth, he learned in the Koyz in Vilna. He did. He learned in the Koyz, went back to the Vilna Gaon, the little base medrash. And to his credit, Rabbi Mazuz says, when he came to write about Ramosha de Leon, he didn't attack him as Gretz and the rest did. They all attacked him. Why? Because they said that he invented the Zohar and all that. And he says that Shulman was much more sensitive to Orthodox sensibilities. And he even respected Kabbalah and the Ramban. And then he says, and we see in the Tmuna you sent me. Let me show you the picture, which I didn't even notice, but he calls attention to this, the thing he's going to. He says, you see in this picture that first of all, he has a beard and payas, okay, which in Vilna was common. And then he says, and the right side of his jacket is over the left side like the Hasidim. So let me explain to you what it's talking about here. First of all, Kalman Shulman, incidentally, he comes from a Chabad background. His father was a Talmud of Rav Aaron of Starishella, who was Chabad, not Lubavitch, but Chabad. In Hasidus, they have this concept, like not for the women. The women, I think your things are already different. Someone sent me something because women, their shirts would go right over left because they'd have servants, the wealthy ones, and it's a lot easier for right-handed. But just think of our jackets, all of us. We take a jacket, like our coat, the buttons are on the right side. Let me show you, the buttons are over here, and then we would put the left side in, and then we put it in, and that's our shirts also. However, that's a problem because the left is over the right, and that's not supposed to be. On the contrary, right is supposed to be over left. What do we say here? It's chesed over gevura, right? Chesed is the right and gevura is the left, or it's the other way around. I can't remember. But in general, right is always supposed to, I think chesed's right and it's supposed to be, it's over gevura, and right is always supposed to be over left. So chesedim, let me just show you a picture, for instance. Let me show you a picture of Lubavitch Rebbe, for instance. Where's my picture of the Lubavitch Rebbe I got? Let me get rid of that. I have a picture here of the Rebbe. Do I have a picture of the Rebbe? Ah, here he is. So look at the Rebbe. Let me enlarge it here for you. Can I enlarge it? Yeah. You see his jacket? And think about your jackets. Your jacket would be the other way. Your jacket, the left side, the buttons would be on the right side. And here you see the buttons are on the left side and the jacket that goes over that's buttoned in is on the right side. So all the jackets we have, it's the other way. I'm trying to think here now. Yeah, the buttons are on the right side and you bring the left. This is such a big deal and it's taken so seriously. I asked one of my Hasidic friends, so what do they do? It seems complicated about jackets. I get it, but what about shirts? He said, there's a whole market even for shirts. So here, for example, you can't go into a regular store, Nordstrom, to get your shirts. So you can go in, this is a place in Borough Park, so you can get a regular white shirt, but here you have Hasidish. So what does Hasidish mean? Well, you click on it. Let's see what it tells us. It says right here, buttoned, Hasidish right to left. So if you're in the Hasidic world, you need your white shirt, you have to go specially and buy a shirt at special places. There's a whole industry that's built up. Some people are more makpid on just the jackets. Everyone is makpid on the kapata. Others are makpid on jackets, but not on shirts. And others are makpid completely on shirts. And my friend who sent me this, Hasidic guy in New York, comes from England, told me that when they didn't have stores like this when he was in England. So what they would do is they would buy women's shirts without ruffles or anything, and they would wear that because the women's shirts go the other way. At least he tells me. I never thought of it before, but any of the women here can tell me if I'm wrong here, but apparently women's shirts do go the other way. And he says it's funny because you could say that this is a Begadisha in order to get for this superstition, or I shouldn't say superstition, it's my Misnagdish approach, for this Hasidic Chumrah, whatever you want to call it. So Rabbi Mazuz points out, if you look at Kalman Shulman, he's wearing his jacket in good Hasidic form, right on top of left. And he says that his books were common in Jerba. And he says, my father told me that one of the big rabbis in Jerba, when he got Mr. A. Paris, he was so entranced by it, he learned it all night. What is Mr. A. Paris? Shulman, he was like, well, these people had their mind, one half of them was in Paris or London, and the other half was in Vilna. He wrote a translation. He thought it was worthwhile to spend his time, maybe between night and day. This is one of the most popular works that appeared in French in the 19th century, Mysteries of Paris. Very, as it says here, it spawned the city's mystery genre. He wrote, Kalman Shulman wrote in Hebrew, nothing like this had ever before appeared in Hebrew, a Hebrew translation of the Mysteries of Paris. And it's funny because in places like Jerba, anything in Hebrew was thought to be special. So they get that work, which today we'd say, this is just Haskalah work. And what do you want to waste your time on that? But they read it. And then he says, but one thing did not find favor in my eyes, that Kalman Shulman writes that he declared a chayrim on the study of philosophy and science for anyone under 25 years old, but he left out medicine. Medicine was always excluded. The chayrim incidentally was for 50 years. And he says that Shulman says the reason he didn't put a chayrim on refuah is because people make money on being a doctor, and you can't tell them that they can't study medicine. Hakesef yonat akol. Kesef, everything, money buys everything. And Ramazu says this is sheker. And you can also make money on other things, cheshbon, v'handasa, etc. But no, the real reason is, he says, why medicine? Because they were worried in those days not to go to a non-Jewish doctor. There was a fear that they would kill you. The Shulchan Aruch even speaks about this. And therefore, that's why medicine was important. Now, as for the maskilim, he says as follows: for us, the word maskil is not ganai. It's not a negative thing. And he quotes some psukim. And then he says, and what you sent me, the letters of Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky and Bialik, he says, same thing we saw a couple of weeks ago. It bothers me. If Ravad Yosef had lived in that generation, he wouldn't have thrown him out of the yeshiva. He would have brought him back. And he says, just like Ravad Yosef did with the reporter from Ma'ariv, apparently he's famous, Adam Baruch. So he went to a Tarbut Ra. He became irreligious. And in the end of his life, he returned. He was a Baal Tshuva because of the influence of Ravad Yosef. And then he says, I saw an article that says that Bialik knew all the Tosfos and Tractate Ketubot Baal Peh. And he says, it's too bad that this person ended up as a heretic. What can we do? Yeshua Yetzer HaYishon, he had a very strong urge to smoke. We know he used to smoke on Shabbos. And then he says, Milvad Yetzarim Acherim, in addition to other inclinations. I guess he's implying sexual inclinations. So, he has two more points. This I'm going to have to wait, even though it's just like five lines, because we're going to get into the issue of Gilgal and Yehuda Aryeh Modna and some other things. So we're going to finish up this. It'll just take us 10 minutes or so. And then we have one more long, long letter to Rabbi Mazuz, which deals with everything from Rashbam and how to pronounce the Sadi and politics and Yeshiva University. Yeshiva University, what is that? Opening refrigerators on Shabbos. How to determine what a kosher bird is. Yashar Mikandia, the Rav Yosef Rosen, the Rugachover, and Yehuda Halevi, and etc., all sorts of good stuff. And then we have more stuff. We have another, we'll probably have two more classes on Mazuz, all sorts of interesting stuff before we return to other figures, including the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe's lengthy letter in English, which we will get to. So, we did 6 pages, but we're still in the same siman. So let's stop here. Oh, one more thing I got to tell you. Okay, before we start, we'll stop. Because I see I made a note of it here. Let me start next class. What does the Zohar have to do with being a maskil? We'll pick up on that next class. I'll show you. I think you'll find that of interest, and the Bahir and some other things. But we'll wait. We'll do that next class. Let me take the questions. The hour goes by very fast. I am telling you, I could sit here for 2-3 hours. I think I'd be looking at it. Of the 50 people here, a few of you will be still looking at them. The rest of you would be falling asleep. But let's go back to the questions. Not because it's not interesting, but it's late. You've had a long day. David Eisen says, a Haredi fellow once argued with me that his community will not say the prayer for the state of Israel or for the soldiers until the religious Zionist community will say a tefillah for the yeshiva students. In response, I asked him if he understood the text of Yikum Porkan, which is for everyone, including them, the leaders, etc. Again, the thing makes no sense, this guy, because they're not saying the prayer for the soldiers. Leave this state out for a minute. They're not saying the prayer for the soldiers as a favor to the religious Zionists or anything like that. They should be saying the prayer for the soldiers because of what the soldiers are doing for them. Rabbi Mazuz on another tape, which you can listen to, I can send anyone, says that the whole thing is idiotic. He says, if someone lends you $10, you say thank you. So some guy's going to take 3 years out of his life to protect you. You're not going to say a thank you. But we understand it. It's all tied up in this hate, this anti-Zionist extremism that has infected the Ashkenazic world, unfortunately, that they'll give legitimacy. I don't know who they is, but if you say the prayer for the soldiers, it's as if you recognize the state, chas v'shalom, and therefore you can't do, even though the two are totally separate. We heard Lorch tells us that every cantor wears it, the same model as the Rav. Rav Moshe Feinstein wore it, Rav David Lifshitz, Rav Unterman. So now I have it, and I can wear it. David says, chutz meaning aside from becomes lahotzi in rabbinic Hebrew, which is indeed similar to outside of. And as we're almost 30 days from the Seder, it's worth noting that the opposite of lahotzi is lahavi, as in Benzoma's teaching, lahavi limos ha-mashiach, that is including the days of the Mashiach, and not to bring. Ah, very nice chiddush, David. So very, very, very nice. As we saw, though, the point of Levinson is that it goes to bar. Bar means both outside as in chutz, but also as in levad, apart from. And he says that comes back into Hebrew, but only into very late Hebrew, as he says, Koheles. And then we see it in Mishnaic Hebrew. I remember when I first studied Biblical Hebrew, that was the first time I learned, I had no idea that the word chazar, it's not biblical Hebrew. You come until you learn biblical Hebrew, you don't realize that in terms of return. In biblical Hebrew, it's shuv. There's so many words that we use that we it's all mixed up. We don't realize that it's not really biblical Hebrew. David says, apropos the introduction of Sephardic pronunciation by Reform Judaism, I always wonder why the newspaper is called in English Yated Ne'eman instead of Yased Ne'eman. I don't know. I wondered that as well, but I'll tell you something else that I was told by Nussan Kamenetsky, that he says, you're wondering, you have to check this. I believe it's true. Nussan Kamenetsky said to me, he was, of course, put in Cheirim by Yated Ne'eman. He said that they don't even know the grammar, that Yated is feminine in Tanakh. It should be Ne'emana. I believe that of the few times it appears, most of the times it's feminine, but I think once it's masculine. But you're right, it should be Yased Ne'eman. I don't know why, because these people won't say the Kotel, it'll be the Kaisel. So, David got it right, Fez. Very nice. Someone privately emails me, there's an article by Rav Hamburgers in the journal Yerush HaSeinu, of Nussan Adler and Sephardic pronunciation, if anyone's interested. It's fascinating because they all cite Rav Nussan Adler. And in my classes on the Chasam Sofer that you cannot see on YouTube, but you can see on, you can listen to them on the Torah in Motion website, which has all sorts of great stuff to listen to in the car and else, other times that we deal with Rav Nussan Adler. Baruch said the more conservative in the Haredi world, the more conservative, they teach Ashkenazic. I was taught Sephardic, but when I turned from my bar mitzvah, I decided to learn the Torah Ashkenazic, and because I figured that's what my father did, and that's the tradition. In JC, where I didn't go for elementary school, I went for high school, they did teach Ashkenazic, as I recall. But my school and my kids, they all learn Sephardic. And yes, Kalman Shulman wears the couple. And Baruch cites some other psukim, Ashrei Maskil, Maskil Aldal. That's the name of the sefer of Rav Hillel Lichtenstein, who's the most extreme of the extremists. So Mark says that's how the buttons are in kittels. Yes, that is. I remember that. Baruch says someone commented that buttoning right over left is a shiloh for men, copying female buttoning matter. I don't know how they could say how far back does that go. What this person sent me was that this is because the servant girls, they would, since they're righties, most of them, that's why the women did it that way. They didn't get dressed themselves. I don't know, but you're right. Maybe we should say it's, if we do the Hasidic way, it's Losil Bashgever. David says, apropos sexual urges, and while probably apocryphal, and again, as Pesach is approaching, Bialik is quoted as referencing the Gemara equating eating matzah on Erev Pesach with having relations with one's fiancé and one's father-in-law's home. Bialik noted, as one who has done both, I can attest that they are not the same. Okay, I've heard that, actually. Baruch says, Re Yated versus Yased. Pronunciation also depends on how you see the name. Okay, that's too complicated here. Oh, okay. Well, Yated is to stand for Yadus Torah Das. And the Stipor said to add on Ne'eman. So if it's an acronym, then it's correct. I wish Rabbi Nussan Kamenetsky was alive, that I would tell him this. He had much anger against Yated Ne'eman because they're the ones who apparently he says, I don't know if it's true, but the Cheirim on him was not supposed to be public. It was supposed to be sent to him. And Yated got a copy of it, and they plastered it on the front page, and then it became official before it was actually given approval from Avil Yashiv to be made public. I don't know if that's true, but being that Yated Ne'eman was the organ that destroyed him and attacked him on its front page every day for a few weeks and published all the cheirims on him, you can see that Rav Nussan Kamenetsky, as with Rabbi Natan Slifkin, they would not be too happy about Yated Ne'eman. So years ago, when my book on the 13 principles came out, someone in Israel asked me, and I'm not sure if he was being serious or sarcastic or joking. He says, if you want to be put in Cherem, I can arrange it, because, and that will increase sales and make it video. I said, no, thank you. I don't need to be put in Cherem. And he says, it's actually quite easy. All you do is you write up a letter saying that so-and-so was spreading bad ideas. You can say it about anyone, and you bring it to a few rabbis. Hey, they don't read English. And if you say that someone's spreading bad ideas, they'll sign on to it. And he says it's quite easy to get anyone to sign on to a cherem. And that's as Rabbi Kamenetsky pointed out. So with this, Rabbi Kelman, I thought we had more questions. I would have gone a couple more minutes, but I see not. Someone texted me, there's a lecture on YouTube, Nussin, the making of a cherem. Yes. He spoke, I think it was at Yeshiva University, gave that talk. But I'll give it to you, Rabbi Kelman, and wish everyone a nice Purim. It's been a year. Remember, last year, this time is when we first recognized, and some people didn't go to shul. It was so. Hopefully, we're nearing the end. Thank you.
Last year, Purim was Okay, thank you very much. Okay, look forward next week, and when
next echo week those- is 40. 40 is a big number in Jewish life.
So yeah, I'm up to 260. I don't know what number are we up to.
Well, this is 40, and I calculate 55 classes.
That's no, I meant altogether. We
altogether.
Have
altogether. Oh, that, yeah. But the YouTube is different because I can. I like.
Okay, it. That's it. One of the silver linings moving to Zoom and YouTube and all that. And please God, soon we'll even have it on our program page on the website. Once we get our new website, which we're in the middle of doing, it's going to take some time.